Peter, worship team, Ulysses, my mom, Ruach in the room. Okay, one quick logistical thing that you may not know. I was having a conversation with our esteemed John. We have a number of men named John. All of them are esteemed, so I'm saying this affectionately. It was a good discussion. We were talking about the perils of trying to clean a menorah. You know what I'm talking about? So you get the wax all over the menorah, and how do you do it? And there's different techniques, and this is what I do. And maybe it's helpful for you. I open my oven. I turn on the lowest heat possible, 175, something like that. I lay a sheet of aluminum foil out with a paper towel on top, and I just lay the menorah on its side for 10 minutes. I'm not your average dummy. But I would caution you, if you do this, please do make sure that your menorah can take the heat. Sometimes, if you put them in the oven, if depending what they're made from, the paint can fade. It's wood, you know, wood can be a problem. So make sure that your menorah can take the heat. But that's my technique. You may have a better technique. Please do tell me afterward. If you have a good way of doing it, let me know. Mine's pretty lazy, by the way. When I pick it up, there's wax on the paper towel, and I just kind of wipe the ends off of the paper towel, and I'm done. And I don't clean it until the next Hanukkah. You know, it's a little bit of wax on the edges, but it's all right. So Hanukkah, there's a couple things that are going on here. We recognize it's a day of great symbols. And the two big symbols, of course, are the menorah and the dreidel. The menorah, and I want to point this out, I know there's some people who may not know this. There's a Hanukkiah, which is a Hanukkah menorah, and there's 9 candle holders on this menorah. There's 8 or 7 candle holders, I'm sorry, on this menorah. There's a difference. So one is for Hanukkah explicitly, specifically, pointedly for Hanukkah. And it's the only time we really use the one with 9 candle holders. One, the middle candle is the Shamash candle, which means the servant candle. Sometimes you'll see it in the end. It's almost always pushed to a side. It's almost distinguished. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's in front, but that all that's is marking is this is the servant candle. This is the candle we light that candle, and then we use it to light the other candles. And that's why there's 8. There's 8 nights for Hanukkah, and then the servant candle. That's why there's 9. This menorah is the symbol of the state of Israel, and this is a typical menorah. This would be the kind of menorah that would have been inside of the Mishkan or the temple or the tabernacle, Mishkan's tabernacle. And when they put menorahs there, it would have looked like this, not like a Hanukkah menorah. So when you see a menorah, if you just count, you know right away, is this a symbol, an ancient symbol of some what was in somebody's house or in the temple itself, or is it for Hanukkah? And it's a good way of noting it. Every now and then people will say, well, why don't you just light the big one? That's kind of nice and big. Well, that would be for lighting a room, you know? So it's a whole different purpose. There's a lot of variety on Hanukkah menorahs. There is no right menorah. Every now and then people will say, well, Jim, what's the, you know, if I get the most traditionally pure menorah, what would it be? I don't know, pottery? I mean, what works for you? You pick what you like. It's like, you know, you pick your clothes and you pick your menorah. And there's a lot of people who spend almost no money on menorahs because they're hard to deal with. They get covered with wax and it's kind of a thing. And then there's people who buy these menorahs that cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And they do it for a family heirloom. And it's all a personal preference. But there's no such thing as a great menorah or not a great menorah. They're all menorahs. They're meant to hold a candle. So we can remember the miracles that God works. So you should always feel good. If you have a menorah, then good. It's typical to put the menorah in a window in a house. I recognize we live in 2025, and like a lot of other years, some people don't like Jews. So putting a menorah in a window sometimes can take a little bit of chutzpah, you know? But that's the traditional place. How traditional? I don't know. But it's old enough that it's traditional. There's a lot of traditions. You know how traditions change over time? Maybe you, when you were a child, you had a family tradition, but now you look at it, you've morphed the tradition in your own family. Hanukkah's no different. The dreidel is the other big symbol. And the funny thing here is we don't have a dreidel here. There's a giant dreidel in the hallway, cardboard dreidel. We've got dreidels in the cafe when we have our service later. Oh, there's a dreidel right here. What am I doing? There's no dreidel. Okay, so this is the other symbol. And this is how we teach children to gamble. So there's two parts to a dreidel. That this is it, and this dreidel just has a base to hold it on. It's, I think it's supposed to symbolize the, well, you're spinning it on. So dreidels basically are four-sided tops. And each side has a symbol, or which also works as a letter. And there's a symbol for another, there's multi values for Hebrew writing, multi values for symbols. So this is a shin. So it's a particular letter, but it also means Lord. And it also means something else. And it also means, so it's got a number of purposes, but each side of the dreidel tells what you do. So you spin a top, and one side, depending how the dreidel lands, one side says you lose a turn, so you get nothing. One side says you win the pot, you have a pot of stuff in front of you. One side says you have to add more to the pot, and one side says you win half of the pot. So that's it, that's the basic for dreidel. But the story behind how dreidel is played, or when dreidel was played over the years, is to me much more interesting than the dreidel itself. And it has truly been used in different ways. It's been used to teach children symbols. It's been used to teach children different values and things like that. But one of the, what I think is a fun thing to know about the dreidel, or a powerful thing really, is when in the 30s, the Nazis were moving through and they had taken over neighborhoods first before the fighting was necessarily really ramped up. And they were driving through these neighborhoods and communities, and they were mandating rules that you couldn't have Bible studies. If you're Jewish, you couldn't have a Bible study anymore. Or if you were Jewish, you couldn't gather together even anymore and practice Jewish holidays. And they were mandating rule changes like this. So what the, in these Jewish neighborhoods, they would have the children go to a house and play dreidel on the porch of a house. And so the kids would play with this dreidel, and that told that two things. First, that told everybody in the neighborhood that inside that house, a Bible study was occurring. That was a way of announcing to everybody, if you saw some kids with a dreidel, go to that house. And the second thing it was, those children spinning the dreidel then became lookouts for what was going on inside of the house. We see bad people coming, you know, so better tell mom or dad, go inside, tell everybody at the Bible study to break up, go in the backyard, have a barbecue. You know, whatever they had to do to avoid the police or the soldiers or the Nazis or whoever was coming in. So the dreidel itself has a lot of cultural meaning. And of course, that's a great way to learn gambling. Usually you play in with these chocolate coins, you know, gelt. Then kids will play with coins. We don't have coins this year. So if you want to play dreidel in the other room, there's a bucket of candy. Use the candy. My guess is some people are going to run out of candy faster than others. It's candy. Can we eat the candy? Yes, it's candy. So if you want to play dreidel, be careful not to eat all of your candy. And if you want to eat candy, don't play dreidel. That's just my little bit of a dreidel candy advice for you. And one other thing I do need to say is, and I mentioned this earlier, please do take the candles home. If you open a box of candles, if there's just candles on the table and no one's claimed them, take them. You're welcome to them. There's matches. Take a tube of matches. That will get you, one of those tubes will actually get you through Hanukkah. If you kind of take care of your match count there, they're actually meant to be enough matches for Hanukkah. And they're nice. They're a little bit longer. So one of the things that we know about Hanukkah is it's not really in the Bible. I mean, it is. It is in the Bible. But it's not a biblically commanded day. If we look at Yom Kippur or Day of Atonement or Feast of Trumpets, or if we look at, you know, Rosh Hashanah, if we look at Pesach or Passover, those are all in scriptures to be mandated and observed. So in other words, God says, remember these. He tells the Jewish people, always remember these things and these promises and the covenants and the actions and all of these types of things. And you can read about it in Numbers, Book of Numbers, and Leviticus and Deuteronomy. They're in all of these books in different ways. Hanukkah was something that occurred long after those writings. It occurred before Yeshua walked the earth, long after. And by the time Yeshua did walk the earth, though, we know, according to John 10, the book of John, chapter 10, that he was at the temple at the time of dedication. That dedication is Hanukkah. Hanukkah is dedication. So he's going to Hanukkah at the time of dedication, which is he's aware in that this is Hanukkah. He knew. What was the tradition like back then? We don't exactly know all of the traditions they had back then. I know, for example, one of our traditions now, and we have tonight, is potato pancakes, latkes, applesauce, or sour cream. Let's do a quick vote. If you have potato pancakes, latkes, how many of you prefer sour cream? Sinners. How many of you prefer applesauce? Winners. I'm kidding. I mean, whatever. It's just, but this is a tradition. Another tradition, and of course, I don't think Yeshua had this tradition, but it was with jelly donuts. Is it Creflock? What's that? I'm not even close. Are you swearing at me? I know the word. I'm not saying the right word. What's Creflock again? I'm getting my. That's for soup?
That's for soup.
You're making this stuff up. I know, I'm teasing you. Okay, jelly donuts. That's what I'm trying to get at. I love a good jelly donut. Now, these are actually not as big as the, what we think of as jelly donuts here in Milwaukee, but they're smaller and they have jelly in them. They're delicious. And I was going to bring some this year, and then I didn't. So I don't know if anybody else brought jelly donuts. I know a number of you. In fact, John, where are you, John? You were making latkes, and thank you for bringing in the latkes, and I'm sure there's applesauce and sour cream here. Other food was brought as well. We'll have a great nosh afterward. Hanukkah itself represents, the story of Hanukkah is interesting to look at in hindsight because we're still dealing with the troubles and the trials of that first Hanukkah, what launched it years ago. It took place B.C. in the 160s. It was the big culmination, 168, 165. Different things happened that led through this time in order to build to the culmination of what we know as the celebration, the reason for the celebration of Hanukkah today. Emperor Antiochus was a Greek ruler at the time, and Antiochus III took control of Jerusalem, of what would be that kind of space in Israel at that time. And he was there, and he took it from the Egyptians, by the way. They weren't free at that point. The Egyptians had kind of taken over, and they let the Jews in that space do whatever they wanted to do. And if they wanted to worship in the temple, they could worship the temple. The Egyptians really didn't care about all that much. They just wanted money and the conquest. So Antiochus III comes, and he takes over from the Egyptians. And at first, he's really not that bad of a guy to the Jews that were living there. He's all right. He lets them do their thing, and life goes on for them. He doesn't put a heavy tax burden on. He lets them worship in the temple. And he had a fight with the Romans. And when the fight with the Romans occurred, he needed more money. So he started to really increase the tax burden against, well, all of his areas. And, of course, the Jews in Jerusalem had to pay this increased tax burden. He eventually died, and his son, Antiochus IV, came, Antiochus Epiphanes, and he came and took over, and he was much more tyrannical. He increased the tax penalty even more, and he really didn't like the idea that the Jews were, that any of the areas really, but specifically the Jews, were still observing their God and their way. He wanted them to fully assimilate with the Greek culture. So bit by bit, he made things illegal in Israel, much like the Nazis said you couldn't worship in your homes, you couldn't have a Bible study in your homes. Antiochus IV said those same types of things. He said you couldn't have a Bible study, you can't go to temple, you can't, and he kept stacking on the rules. If you do these things, he said, you'll die. And the Jews, some of them assimilated, and most, though, didn't. In fact, they were pretty rebellious. And ultimately, it got to the point where Antiochus IV sent soldiers in, and there was really a big issue. They took one of the things that Antiochus did was to rename the temple. This is the temple of the Lord. He renamed it the Temple of Zeus. That's not good. And then another thing he did was to, he took pigs, and there's a story that he go into one of the rabbis at the time, one of the leading rabbis at the time, and said, you've got to eat pork. And the leading rabbi said, never, I'll never eat pork. So they killed him, and they made a martyr out of this, it wouldn't be called a rabbi, but a martyr of this priest at the time. And they tried to mandate eating pork. They took pigs because, in the scriptures, Jews don't eat. They don't eat pork. And they don't have anything. Boy, I'm getting gassed up here. They don't have anything to do with the with pork. So he brought pigs into the temple of Zeus, and he had them slaughtered on the altar that was used to slaughter animals for the Lord, according to the scriptures. But he put pigs on it to defy the altar, to defy, have the blood spilled in the in this in what would be, you know, the holy ground at the time. And it was a tremendous thing that he did. And a priestly family got together and said, "We're not going to deal with this anymore." And they started a revolt. And this went on for some time. Judah Maccabee was the son of this priest and his family that started the revolt. And he led ultimately the overturning, the retaking of the temple. And it was a tremendous thing. And they really did get control of this temple. They had control for some time. There was even from this point, there was a bit of a window where nobody really told them what to do in their land. They had a type of an independence again. They were poor, didn't have any unity, any money, any army, but they had control of their land for, you know, ish 100 years or something like that, and depending on which timeline you look at in history. And it was a really powerful time. A lot of good things came from that time. Some, you know, messed up things too, but a lot of good things came. In fact, Rabbi Frank's got he's been working on a study. And at some point, I know he's going to share on some of the good and some of the challenging that came through this era. But it was a big era. And as we look back on it, we go, boy, the Maccabee clan that got together and fought, we're receiving the benefits of that today. Had the Jews at the time either been killed or assimilated, we would not be here. The Messiah would not have been born. He would have been gone. And I mean, for a minute, I've got to just stop and say, you know, the killing of Jews is still happening. How many of you heard about the killing of 12 Jews today, really, in Australia? Have you heard about that? There was a group, there was a Hanukkah party, and two men showed up with guns in Australia and just started doing their thing. And it's just a terrible thing. It still goes on. And had it been an end way back then, we wouldn't be here. So, you know, we come together like this and we go, "Thank you, God, for preserving us. All of these years, thank you, God, for your preservation and your promises to your people." Because there would be nothing. There would be no Jesus. There would be no Christmas. There would be no Judeo-Christian values. There would be no American legal system. There would be none of this stuff. The American legal system is built on the Judeo-Christian values. It would all have been gone in 165-ish BC. I mean, the ramifications of what happened, the success from that revolt, go on today. They're a big deal for us. The survival of the Jewish people. But the most amazing thing in that time, from that revival, it was more not revival, I should say, the rebellion. The most amazing thing to me is that it wasn't necessarily about life and death. If they didn't assimilate it, then they would die. Antiochus IV made that clear. But it's the fact that they had to deal with assimilation. Assimilation is that quiet way of ending a belief system. It's a quiet way of wrapping it all up. And Antiochus tried to put an end to it. He didn't go in heavy-handed and say, you know, "You will assimilate." He went in quietly, bit by bit by bit. "Don't do this anymore. Don't do this anymore. Don't do this anymore." You know, we're living in a time where assimilation runs rampant. Rampant for believers, rampant for Jews. One of the things that's going on, and I'm just going to be a homer here for a minute at Beth Messiah, and bear in mind that we're a Messianic Jewish congregation, so I'm going to speak to the Jewish believers here for a moment. There's people from churches that want you to leave Beth Messiah and go to the church. They say, "Hey, don't go there anymore. Now you're a believer. Now you should go to a church." Where did the Gentiles go before there was a church? They went to a Jewish community, didn't they? So I don't know why in 2025 people are saying leave the Jewish community and go here, because they didn't start like that. If you ever hear anybody saying leave Beth Messiah and go to, this happens all over the world. Leave the Jewish community of believers and go to this Gentile community of believers instead. What? It's a kind of assimilation. You know, we deal with assimilations of believers all the time. Here's one example. Whatever your religion is, keep it private. True. So all of a sudden we get this sense that, well, it's my thing. I'll just keep it private. I won't tell anybody what I believe. We're supposed to tell people what we believe. And people say, well, don't mix your religion in my government. It's already mixed. Our legal system, Judeo-Christian legal system, it's already mixed. My system's mixed. I'm not going to keep it private. And I am going to mix my system with our government. Because I can't keep my system private. If we do try to keep it private, and if we're not who we're supposed to be, and who we're called out to be as believers in Messiah, then we assimilate. We can't do it on our own. My dad's got an expression, it's a great expression. It's the principle of the charcoal. You know, if you imagine a pile of charcoal briquettes, pile of charcoal squares, they make a mound, you know, you stack them all together and you light them, and it takes a little time for them to heat up, but eventually they become quite hot. If one of those charcoal briquettes tumbles away from the mound, boom, 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 it goes out. It gets isolated. It goes out. It becomes kind of assimilated with the temperature around. This is our chance as believers to remember, really Hanukkah is our reminder, to remember that we can't go out. We can't assimilate with the world. We can't. We always have to be distinctive from the world. We are the light to the world. We're the salt. We're the flavor in the world. This is what the scriptures say. And Hanukkah reminds us, don't assimilate. Fight not to assimilate. Fight it. Don't get pulled in. Our God is greater. So we're blessed for the story of Hanukkah. We're blessed to remember that God reminds us that God's taken care of us. He's brought us to this day. We should Shekhianu. This is this blessing we said at the start of the service. He brought us. He sustained us to reach this season, December 2025. We can't assimilate. If Judah Maccabee was here right now, what would we say to him? Good job. Way to go. Thanks for the lesson. We can't assimilate. Amen? So we remember that on Hanukkah. This is the story of Hanukkah. There was a miracle back then, and all the way, all these thousands of years later, we're still rejoicing because of that one miracle in that one city, led and started off being led by one family. Tell me one person doesn't make a difference. Don't assimilate. All right, so what I'd like to do, I'm going to change gears here a little bit. We're almost done with our service portion of the night. We have a tradition here at Beth Misai. It started way back when. This is led by our very own Jason Waller, Senior.